From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it has been a waiting game much of the day at a federal court in Washington, D.C., but now the judge has delayed the sentencing of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, setting a status hearing for March. Flynn pled guilty a year ago to lying to investigators about his conversations with then-Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak before Donald Trump took office, and the conversations were about easing sanctions on Russia. Flynn has cooperated with special counsel Robert Mueller, who recommended little prison time for him, citing his substantial help with the investigation. NPR justice correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us now from Washington. And Ryan, Reuters is reporting that Flynn's lawyers asked for the delay so that he could cooperate more in the investigation, because that will, you know, affect his sentencing. What's your sense?
Well, Flynn's lawyer, a man by the name of Robert Kellner, did say that Flynn may testify in a federal case against two of Flynn's former business associates. These are two men who are actually charged. Their indictment was unsealed yesterday for basically working as a foreign agent of the Turkish government, not disclosing that they were lobbying on behalf of the Turkish government. This would be one way for basically Flynn to kind of eke out a little bit more cooperation with the government in this plea agreement that he's had with them.
Well, we've reported on that today elsewhere in the program, that these were two associates that were working with Flynn and Flynn's company, Intel, to work with the Turkish government to undermine a cleric who's living in exile in Pennsylvania. And Flynn even wrote an op-ed, a scathing op-ed about this cleric that Turkey wants to be brought back to that country. They think that he was involved with a coup. So that's a very complicated story there about two Turkish men. But you are saying that he wants to be able to, what, cooperate as much as he can before his sentencing?
Well, that he may testify in that case. Basically, that is a case when Flynn's pre-sentence report came out, there was a lot of kind of mystery surrounding a line about two other investigations that Flynn had provided information to prosecutors about. And the inference at the time was that it was probably his business partners and lobbying that they had done, undisclosed lobbying on behalf of the Turkish government. When that indictment came down yesterday, it kind of all came together and it was clear that that was indeed a case that he had provided information on.
Look, one aspect of this is that Flynn's supporters have criticized the FBI. They say they didn't tell Flynn before their interview with him that lying to the FBI is a federal crime. Now, many have said that as a national security advisor, Flynn would know that. But this had been a continuing theme at the White House. And on Fox News this morning, Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was asked if the prosecutor's tactics, you know, in this investigation were illegal.
That's something that the court will have to determine whether or not it was illegal, but it was certainly inappropriate and certainly not the way that the FBI should conduct itself as the leading law enforcement agency of this country.
So she's staying there with this story from the White House that Flynn was entrapped. The FBI didn't tell him that it's not. I'm sorry, but, you know, this is something we tell our kids. You know, you can't lie to the FBI. We tell them the Nixon story. Well, the judge today actually asked Flynn's lawyers if Flynn felt he was entrapped, and they said Flynn didn't.
Well, I mean, I think that prosecutors made very clear in court filings that they made to the judge that, you know, a former director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, a decorated military veteran, a man who was appointed national security advisor, doesn't need to be told before he talks to the FBI that he shouldn't lie to the FBI. He knew full and well that he should not lie to the FBI. And there's also been some complaints from Flynn's lawyers, as well as folks on Fox News and within kind of the pro-Trump circles, that the FBI was somehow underhanded in its interview with Flynn, because they didn't tell him that he should have a lawyer present. They offered for him to. He decided that he didn't want to. That's on Flynn. And this is not unusual behavior by the FBI in how it interviews people and conducts its affairs.
LaGuardia, I'm going to toss one to you. The president tweeting out today in support of Michael Flynn, his former national security advisor, saying good luck and saying once again there is no collusion in the Russia investigation. You know, some see tweets like that as a sign that he's still very much siding with his national security advisor, who has pled guilty. What is the sense of, you know, whether President Trump will pardon him, whether that has anything to do with extending the sentencing so that there can be more cooperation or his involvement in other trials? What's your sense here?
Well, there's no indication that that has anything to do with the extended deadline for sentencing. We did expect a sentence to come down today. It did not. We'll get a full readout as to why. As far as a pardon, we haven't had a lot of chatter around a possible pardon for Flynn in the same way that we've heard around President Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort. There's been a lot of questions about that. It was actually brought up in conversations. The president brought it up in conversations with his legal team. They kicked that can down the road, but it has continued to come up. And President Trump didn't knock off the table the question of a pardon for Manafort even just a few weeks ago. Those sorts of conversations we have not heard in public involving Michael Flynn.
Yeah. Quite a day. NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Well, the Trump administration proposed a new rule this fall that could make it harder for legal immigrants to get a visa to travel overseas if they use or are likely to use certain public benefits like Medicaid or food stamps. The administration argues the proposed public charge rule promotes self-sufficiency, but immigrant advocates disagree. From Houston Public Media, Elizabeth Troval reports.
So you're up for renewal for your food stamps? You're up for renewal for Medicaid?
Esmeralda Cedillo helps low-income families sign up for food stamps and Medicaid through the Houston Food Bank.
Oh, my first boy. Yes. He just melts my heart.
They show you pictures of their children, and whenever they have a question, they reach out to me, and they say, Esmeralda, I have this. What can I do to fix this?
They go to Cedillo because she gets it. Her parents are immigrants.
I went through the poverty. I went through seeing my parents' fear.
She works a lot with the Latino community and says since the start of the Trump administration, her client base has dropped dramatically.
So from 80 that we had in 1 week, it's dropping to 15. The highest we've seen is 20.
Cedillo says people come to her in fear of jeopardizing their immigration status or worse, being deported. She says the administration's proposed public charge rule is making matters worse. The rule would have immigration officials factor low salaries, the use of public benefits, even the likely use of public benefits when evaluating someone's visa application. Critics of the proposed rule, including Cedillo, say that sends a message to people who come for help. If you want to live in this country, you must fend for yourself.
And that was the hardest story I can hear, was that of 8 household members, the parents decided to not to ask for help from the country, that their kids being born here was more than enough. It was a blessing for them. And they were just going to file their taxes and work and see how they would provide medical and food assistance.
Another example of how this fear is playing out is through access to the nutritional assistance program, WIC. Since Trump took office, Houston has seen a 20% decline in enrollment. Zara Kupai runs the federally funded program for the city.
Since election, we went from 72,000 caseload to right now, we're barely 58,000.
And Kupai says the numbers will continue to drop if the public charge rule goes into effect. That's why the city of Houston's health department and other local health organizations are voicing opposition to the rule. Houston Health Authority Dr. David Peirce co-authored a letter against it to the Department of Homeland Security.
If you put fear into people so that they won't even take care of the assets that we have available, the situation is just going to get much worse.
He says the immigrant community has limited access to health care as it is.
And there's going to be a human price to be paid. And there's going to be a worse financial price to be paid, too. So it's a lose-lose proposition.
Peirce argues the new rule will have a domino effect. Fewer people will get preventative care, which means more will depend on more expensive emergency care. On top of that, Peirce says fewer people will get vaccinated, more kids will go without food. All factors that will make the city sicker. But not everybody agrees. Matthew O'Brien is a researcher for the Federation for American Immigration Reform, which calls for scaling back immigration to the U.S. He says these community health fears are alarmist and that poor immigrant families cost the country too much money.
I mean, unless we have some kind of outbreak of disease of, you know, the type that we haven't seen since the late 19th century in the United States, you're not going to have those costs offset the costs that are being borne by the American taxpayer in order to provide these benefits in the first place.
More than 200,000 advocacy groups, health professionals, and citizens across the country provided public comment for or against the public charge rule. The Department of Homeland Security is expected to come out with a final rule early next year. For Here and Now, I'm Elizabeth Trovall in Houston.
There is still a lot of work to do in the final days of the 115th Congress. On Friday at midnight, key federal agencies will shut down if lawmakers and the president can't come up with a deal to keep the government funded. But this is also a time to reflect in Washington. Members of Congress who are retiring or lost their reelections in November are looking back at their careers on Capitol Hill. It's something of a tradition for outgoing senators from both parties to publicly say goodbye to their colleagues. And we're going to take a moment now to hear some extended excerpts from those speeches on the Senate floor, starting with Heidi Heitkamp, a Democrat from North Dakota who lost her seat to a Republican after just one term.
In 2000, I was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. And after I got done with treatment, my oncologist told me, you have a 28% chance of living more than 10 years. Think about that. So I knew right away that I had a chance to use what time God gave me for good and noble purposes, to try and do the things that I always thought needed to be done in this country. And it's an important lesson for all of you. The greatest gift you have is not your bank account. Your greatest gift that you have is the amount of time you have left on this earth and what you do with that time. And I chose, for good or bad, to come to the United States Senate. I think when we have a world of options and we make this choice, it is so important that we come here with purpose, not just to be named a senator, not just for the trappings of office, but for purpose. So the truth is, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm from Manador, North Dakota. It's a town of 90 people. When I was growing up, my family was 1/10 population, I just have to say. And my dad was a World War II veteran who loved education, read the paper every day, believed in this country, but he was never given a chance to go to high school. My family struggled to get by. And when you look at it, you think about this. You think about a country where somebody from my background could actually become a United States senator.
Senators from both parties said lawmakers must learn to work together again. That was the message from Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, a moderate Democrat from a red state who also lost to a Republican.
To all of my fellow senators and all the many people who work here in the Senate, I'd be lying if I didn't say I was worried about this place. It just doesn't work as well as it used to. The Senate has been so enjoyable for me, but I must admit, it puts the fun in dysfunction. Peter Morgan, an author, said, "No family is complete without an embarrassing uncle." We have too many embarrassing uncles in the United States Senate. Lots of embarrassing stuff. The United States Senate is no longer the world's greatest deliberative body. And everybody needs to quit saying it until we recover from this period of polarization and the fear of the political consequences of tough votes. Writing legislation behind closed doors, giant omnibus bills that most don't know what's in them, K Street lobbyists knowing about the tax bill manager's package before even senators. That's today's Senate. And no amendments. My first year in the Senate was 2007. We voted on 306 amendments in 2007. This year, as of yesterday, we voted on 36. That's a remarkable difference. Something is broken, and if we don't have the strength to look in the mirror and fix it, the American people are going to grow more and more cynical, And they might do something crazy like elect a reality TV star president.
Utah's Orrin Hatch was the longest-serving Republican senator in history. He's retiring in January after more than four decades in Washington. He also spoke about Senate dysfunction in his farewell address.
I was here when the regular order was the norm, when legislation was debated in committee, and when members worked constructively with one another for the good of the country. I was here when we could say without any hint of irony that we were members of the world's greatest deliberative body. Times have certainly changed. Over the last several years, I have witnessed the subversion of Senate rules, the abandonment of regular order, and the full-scale deterioration of the judicial confirmation process. Polarization has ossified. Gridlock is the new norm. And like the humidity here, partisanship permeates everywhere, everything we do. On both the left and the right, the bar of decency has been set so low that jumping over it is no longer the objective. Limbo is the new name of the game. How low can you go? The answer, it seems, is always lower.
Hatch also urged compromise on social issues.
Protecting religious liberty and preserving the rights of LGBTQ individuals are not mutually exclusive. I believe we can find substantial common ground on these issues that will enable us to both safeguard the ability of religious individuals to live their faith and protect LGBTQ individuals from invidious discrimination. In my home state, we were able to strike such a balance with the historic Utah Compromise. No doubt we can replicate that same success on a federal level. That's why, as one of my final acts as a U.S. Senator, I challenge my colleagues to find a compromise on this crucially important issue.
Dean Heller from Nevada was the only incumbent Republican to lose a Senate seat in the midterms.
Since coming to Washington, D.C., my number one focus has always been the people of Nevada and putting our state's priorities first. For example, I worked with Senator Martin Heinrich from New Mexico to level the playing field for the development of new alternative energy technologies to support Nevada's energy diversification. And I have worked with Senator Feinstein throughout my career to deliver resources to protect the Tahoe Basin and fight devastating wildfires. Whether it's leading the Republican charge to extend unemployment benefits in 2014, when Nevada's unemployment rate was nearly double what it is now, or breaking with my party to pass the Violence Against Women's Act, I've always been willing to work with anyone who has good ideas to help move Nevada families and Nevada communities forward.
One of the most closely watched Senate elections in the country this fall was in Florida, where Democratic Senator Bill Nelson narrowly lost to Governor Rick Scott. In his farewell speech, Nelson called attention back to John McCain, the senator from Arizona who died in August.
I caution those who will join this body to resist the pulls of partisan acrimony and the forces that seek to divide us. Tribalism is our problem, and if not corrected, it's going to take our country down. And I know I'm just another senator saying what a lot of senators that are departing are saying. As we all here remember, right over at that desk there, John McCain, in one of his last Senate addresses that he could stand, said the same thing. Now, some of my fondest memories in the Senate have been with those who sit on the other side of that center aisle. And because of this, I know that while Republicans and Democrats may disagree on policy, we have a lot to unify us in our values and principles that we share. And so my parting words are that there's no greater challenge for this Senate than to have the moral courage to choose country over party or over power, to choose justice instead of the few, justice for all, and to give others respect instead of condemnation.
McCain's colleague from Arizona, Jeff Flake, also spoke. The retiring Republican and frequent critic of President Trump recalled the fall of the Soviet Union in the late 1980s and cautioned that the road to democracy is not irreversible.
We are, of course, testing the institution of American liberty in ways that none of us ever imagined we would, and in ways that we probably never should again. My colleagues, to say that our politics is not healthy is somewhat of an understatement. I believe that we all know well that this is not a normal time, and that the threats to our democracy from within and without are real. And none of us can say with confidence how the situation that we now find ourselves in will turn out. Let us recognize from this place here today that the shadow of tyranny is once again enveloping parts of the globe. And let us recognize, as authoritarianism reasserts itself in country after country, that we are by no means immune.
The 116th Congress will be sworn in on January 3rd. 53 Republicans will control the Senate.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
China's President Xi Jinping marked 40 years of economic reform with a major speech today. She said China, with the world's second largest economy, will not develop at the expense of any other country. But he also said Beijing will not be pushed around by any other country. Joining us now is the BBC's Stephen McDonnell. He's in Beijing. Stephen, in this speech, President Xi did not take on the trade war between the U.S. and China directly, did he?
No, that's right. He didn't specifically refer to the United States or the trade war, but I think the reference made by Xi Jinping to nobody dictating how China's economy should develop was seen by many China observers as a reference to the US saying that the Chinese economy should open up more. You know, it was quite a strident speech in that way. In fact, in many respects, he was saying that unapologetically that the military is fully controlled by the Communist Party, that the Communist Party is at the heart of everything here. And in fact, the courts, human rights, and things like this have been improved by party control. And I think on those last two points, again, many China watchers would think that's a bit rich of him trying to put that argument in the climate of things as they are today under Xi Jinping's rule. However, on other fronts, like economic development, even the most hardened, I guess, cynical China watcher would have to say the party has had its achievements. He also spoke about the environment, for example, and how there's been a big price to pay in China for this breakneck economic growth in terms of soil, air, water pollution, and that China has to move in a more green direction. So it was a broad-ranging speech that went on for 1.5 hours, touching many subjects. And the message was there's going to be improvements in the future, but with the party firmly in control.
I was speaking to a friend who does business in China, he's based in China, the other day, who said that for the first time that he can remember, that people in China, powerful people in China, are starting to think, well, maybe this economy is not going to just keep going up and up and up and up for as far as the eye can see, the way that it has been for so long. Did you get any sense of a lack of confidence in China's economy in the speech today from President Xi?
Absolutely not. His the tone of his speech was, we're all go. I mean, he didn't even, for example, acknowledge the big problems with debt. When you hear the Premier here speak, he's much more likely to acknowledge such problems. Nothing like that from Xi Jinping today. No reference to potential housing bubbles or anything like that. It was just, we've had this remarkable growth, the envy of other countries. It's hovered around 9% for decades. I mean, many Chinese leaders below him have tried to talk down these expectations in recent years and said China needs better growth, better quality growth, not just fast growth, because high-speed growth has produced all sorts of anomalies and sort of bridges to nowhere. And so other leaders are quite open in terms of talking about that as a problem. But we had none of that from Xi Jinping today. It was just, this has been a remarkable achievement from our party. And so there was not much of a suggestion of any vulnerability whatsoever in the Chinese system today.
That's the BBC's Stephen McDonald joining us from Beijing. Stephen, thank you.
Good to speak to you.
One year ago this month, the Lilac Fire blazed outside San Diego in Southern California. Homes were destroyed, more than 4,000 acres scorched. Thousands of people were evacuated. Thankfully, none of them died. But this is horse country, and nearly 50 horses were killed at the San Luis Rey Training Center in Bonsall. Trainers and owners racing stall to stall to lead their horses from blazing barns were themselves burned. Joe Herrick is one such owner, severely burned, trying to save a favorite filly named Lovely Finish. Well, this can be a hard, hard story to listen to, but while these headlines come and go, these stories stay with those living them, and we wanted to see how they're doing. So we're checking in with Joe Herrick. Joe, how are you doing?
Good, Robin. It's been a little over a year, and we're getting our feet back under us here at San Luis Rey, yes.
You know, we think about the horses all the time, and everyone is concerned about their pets, but these are huge animals. How do you get them out? This was always on your mind, right, the possibility of fire?
Yeah, we'd had a lot of close calls before, but the fire always seemed to go around us, and it hit my barn, and, you know, I did manage to get another horse out before I got Lovely Finish out. And that horse ran back into the stall, ran back into the security of the barn and perished. So her name was Sarah Sunshine. So.
Yeah.
And Martine Balak's barn also got hit first. You know, she was trying to get her horse out of the stall, and her horse would not leave the stall. So she got burned a lot, much, much worse than I did.
Oh boy. And how's she doing?
She lost her leg below her knee, and she still, marches on. She's amazing.
Wow. Well, you all were trying to get the horses to someplace safe when suddenly, you know, we forget palm trees, eucalyptus trees. The palm trees are dry. The eucalyptus trees are oil. These things explode. I just want to put this in context. I mean, there are some people there who make millions with these racing horses. How would you characterize yourself?
Well, thankfully, I had a career before the training, so I was in the hotel motel business. It allowed me to do what I wanted to do, which was train racehorses. So I've been doing it for 23 years.
You're doing okay. You're not, you know, a kabillionaire because of horse racing. You know, the horses are part of your business. But what else are they to you?
Well, this filly, she ran second first time out at Del Mar, and my phone rang off the hook for weeks, people wanting to buy her. So I turned down, over $250,000 because I was so attached to her, and it wouldn't have been fair to her. The grooms were calling her my girlfriend, so it was I have the luxury of not having to sell something that's so valuable.
Yeah. Well, so let's continue. I mean, it's a terrible day. You mentioned Martine Balak, an owner trying to get a horse out. She's burned terribly. You get one horse out. The horses, naturally, when things started to explode, they ran back into the barns, which, of course, are filled with things that are just going to go up in flames. You get this filly Lovely Finish out. What happened?
Well, there's stalls on each side of the barn, and there was only four bedded stalls on the other side of the barn. We had wet those down for over an hour, soaked them, and they still ignited with all the heat and flaming debris that came in. And when those stalls ignited, it got my side going.
It sounds horrible. You know, horses burning, panicking. You have these palm trees exploding. You and the horse are burning at this point. Horrendous. You hose her. You take her back into the barn to kind of build a fortress around the two of you.
Uh-huh.
But then a veterinarian comes. He's saying, everybody, you got to get out. And at first you brush people off, but then you go with the firefighters who've come. Ask the vet to shoot your horse up with some painkillers. You end up in the hospital with these horrible burns. And I understand you just couldn't stay there. You can't sleep because that's all you can think about.
Yeah, my filly was at Helen Woodward Animal Clinic, and they did a great job with her over there, but I was anxious to get back to her, and they thought I was going to need skin grafts. Mm. And I avoided that, and I got out of there in 12 days.
I'm wondering, how do you get rid of that nightmare of that day?
Well, it stays with you. You rely on your faith and your friends, your family.
Yeah. They didn't want to tell you in the hospital that six of your horses had died.
Yeah, I pretty much knew. My barn went up in seconds, so I pretty much knew.
Yeah. And by the way, it's been a year. How are your burns, your arms, your face?
Yeah, there's still some, you know, the skin, like, on top of my wrist feels like cardboard, and it's stiff, and there's some loss of sensation here and there. But, you know, I went back to playing soccer 5 weeks after I got done because I just needed to exhaust my body so I wouldn't have the nightmares.
Yeah. Well, and it sounds like you and Lovely Finish also helped heal each other. She had been rescued by some who knows who, you know, people who rescued some of these horses, get them in trailers and got them to a recovery area for her. But she was burned. We've seen the pictures. And you started, what, slowly walking her?
Well, yeah, she, you know, she was racing fit, and so she needed exercise. And, you know, her skin was horrible, but her body was still super fit. She needed to move. So after a couple more days in the clinic, I brought her home to my place, and I was able to hand walk her two or three times a day. And that turned into hand jogging because she needed to do more. So it helped me get back fit, and her back fit, you know, her moving, because she was, you know, she was racing fit. She had a lot of energy that needed to, you know, be let out.
You know, I hadn't thought of that. It's hard enough to tell a trainer like you got to stay in bed. But to tell a horse, a racehorse can't rest. So she needed to have this movement.
Yeah, and she couldn't be out during the daytime because her skin was so sensitive. But at night, she could be out in a like a 12 by 24 area that the back of her stall, we'd open it up, and she'd go out into her area so she could be out all night.
I mean, when you hear this and when you hear the description of what happened and the fireballs and the, you know, the panic and the horses bucking and stampeding and trying to get back in the, I mean, just, it's unimaginable. But the center's reopened, I understand.
Yeah, 250 stalls were completely destroyed. 250 stalls were just fine. There was 500 horses there. So they rebuilt 250 stalls and they got us back in there April 15th.
Is there more protection against fires?
We've been stabled at Del Mar over a month now so they could install the fire sprinkler system. So now we're going back to barns that are a little bit safer and more protected.
I do worry, though. I mean, we see the fires up and down the state.
Yeah, you're definitely aware. We're in California. We got it all. We got fires and floods and mudslides and everything else, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, are there more plans in place for getting these horses out?
Well, the problem was they wouldn't let horse trailers in to get us out of there. The only option was turning these horses loose. And really, CAL FIRE was telling us, you know, shelter in place, shelter in place. And then at 1 o'clock, it was like, okay, evacuate.
Mm.
Well, an hour later, it hits the van. So, you know.
Well, and the thinking was turn the horses loose because they'll run away from, you know, hopefully they'll get a chance to get away from the fire. But they all went back in the barn.
A lot of them did get injured running around. It was, you know, the memories that we witnessed are horrific.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Well, but it sounds as if some of those images are being replaced. Because, do you understand, Lovely Finish is racing again?
Yeah, she's run really well. She's ran 2/3, and she ran second the other day against much tougher horses. She just keeps improving.
You know, Joe, I'm going to hear from people who are going to say, how could you put this poor horse out on the track who's been burned and is scarred, and why don't you just give her the rest of her life in a field with dandelions? What would you say to that?
I would say that she loves racing. She loves the attention that she gets every day. These horses are cared for more than they're ever going to be for the rest of their life.
So she's placing in the money, it sounds like, in some cases. But would you care if she didn't? I mean, it sounds like you wouldn't.
No. Right after the fire, I was like, I don't care if she never runs again. But she's super smart. She's figuring this racing thing out.
Survivors.
Yeah.
Both of you.
Yeah.
Joe Herrick, again, a trainer at the San Luis Rey Training Center in Bonsall, California, along with his horse, Lovely Finish. Turning their backs on the past year and the terrible 2017 Lilac Fire. Thanks so much, Joe.
Thank you.
And our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, has been thinking about the culinary highlights of 2018 as this year comes to a close. Mm-hmm. Last week, she brought us her choices for best cookbooks. And now, Kathy, you are back with more discoveries. First of all, a piece of equipment that is a must in any kitchen, which
absolutely.
Is a knife.
A knife. And you know, you'll talk to chefs and everybody has their favorite knife. And chefs have big rolls of knives that they travel with. These I really fell in love with this year. And just by looking at them, you can understand. These are knives from New West Knife Works.
We should say we're going to have pictures at HereNow.org.
We are, because they are super pretty.
Yeah.
These are American-made knives. They are made in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Wow. And it is a beautiful tool that is functional and durable. The handles have this almost technicolor fiberglass color on the handle. And I just think they're so stunning.
This is a big knife.
You have a big chef's knife. Robin has a smaller knife.
Because I shouldn't have any knife. I am so...
Yes, we've heard. The rumors about you are all true, right?
Well, and you know, also, I ended up buying, as many people here where we are did, I ended up buying a set of knives this year from one of those young students putting herself through college.
Oh, Robin,
I know.
No.
Keep going, because
no.
I want to know how
Thank
do you buy
you.
Knives.
I'm going to interrupt you right
Go ahead.
There.
Go
okay.
Ahead.
I want you guys to pick up this knife because... Yes, it's beautiful. Yes, it's American made. It's made from American steel, but it feels so good in your hand that when you're chopping, I know a lot of people say to me all the time, oh, do you use a Cuisinart for that? Or, oh, do you use it? And I'm like, no, I really love to chop. It is something that I get into the zen of. It calms me down. And I have to say, these knives out of Wyoming are really a joy in my kitchen.
How do you know they're a good knife?
Well, they cut really well. Yeah. It's really good steel. It works for peeling and paring and boning and carving. I use them.
This one knife?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you get one of their really good chef knives, and you can use it for all kinds of things.
How many knives do you think you need in the kitchen? I think that the ones I absolutely must have are one like this, a big
chef's knife.
Big chef's knife.
Like 6 inches.
A bread knife.
A serrated knife.
Right, exactly. Yep. And then a small knife.
Yeah, some depends.
Like a lime.
It depends how much you do. If you ask my husband, he says you need only one. I have a lot of knives, and I like to peel tomatoes with a certain knife. I like to cut peel off of oranges and grapefruits. Anyway, don't get me started. I am a big fan of these knives.
Okay, well, we'll have the pictures and more information there because we have so many other things to do. Just don't do as I did and mistake a cheese knife for a pie server and lick it. Okay,
It gets worse every time.
Let's talk about salt.
I was thinking about what's the best spice I've used this year. And, I thought of za'atar and I thought of smoked cinnamon and I thought of different types of cumin seeds and fennel seeds. But when it gets right down to it, I am obsessed with Malden sea salt. Mm. This is made in the town of Malden, which is in the county Essex. It has been made in England, in this small town, since 1882. Mm. There are several things that are distinct about it. Mm. Just look at it. You both have a little pile. These are pyramid-shaped crystals.
They're huge.
And this is what you call a finishing salt. And what that means is that you might not necessarily sprinkle this sea salt into your soup as it's simmering or into a sauté. This is the salt you sprinkle on at the very end.
Put it on the top of an avocado. Put
it, brilliant. That is exactly it. I
brilliant,
love
Jeremy.
It on avocado. Oh, you know? Little Miss Cut herself over here.
But you know what? I'm tasting it, and it explodes on a piece of bread.
Brilliant, Robin.
Thank you.
Okay? No wonder you guys are hosts. You're both brilliant. The truth is, it brings out the flavors of all the foods you're cooking with. You taste it on a piece of bread and butter. I brought you a plain slice of a baguette with butter. I sprinkle on that salt, and a plain old piece of bread and butter is suddenly... got texture and excitement. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I love it. You've had it on cookies and things like that.
I put it on cookies. I sprinkle it on cakes. I sprinkle it on brownies. I sprinkle it on avocados. I put it on top of soups and stews and dips and tarts. And I use a lot of it.
We have to get to this taco before we run out of time.
Please.
So tell us. What have you done
here? Here's how it happened. I met a woman in Detroit named Serena Maria Daniels. She's the creator of an online magazine called Tostada. And she told me about this place. There are these taco trucks in Detroit called El Parian. Right. There are about four or five of them. We're going to give you the links. You can find them. I eat out a lot when I travel. It's part of my job. I like to see what people are doing. I taste things that people are raving about. I taste expensive things. I taste inexpensive things. The bite of the pork taco at El Parian was the single bite that stayed with me this year as the most exuberant piece of food that I tasted. And I tried. My attempt to recreate the El Parian taco is not exactly right, because what happens when you go there is you see meat in a bubbling vat of braising liquid with onions and spices. And just before they serve it, they chop the meat up, put it on a griddle, put it on top of a beautiful corn tortilla, pickled onions, pickled radishes, and you've got it.
Yeah, and if you can't get to Detroit, when Kathy starts a sentence with, I met a woman in Detroit, you know it's going to have a great
ending.
It's a long
story.
We'll have all of this at herenow.org. Kathy Guns, your picks of the year, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.